Sunday or Monday when the first multinational peace is Democracy Now. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now.
As a foreigner and a journalist, particularly an American journalist, I know that I enjoy a certain de facto political leeway that enables me to say things that local people would be killed for saying. I have tried to use that privilege to tell the truth about TNI Aubrey. If because of this the Army feels they must arrest or jail me, then I know that there is nothing I can do to stop them.
American journalist Alan Nairn, facing imprisonment or deportation from Indonesia, speaks from detention. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Australia delayed vital airdrops of food today to tens of thousands of East Timorese who fled their homes in the wake of a terror campaign by Indonesian military-backed militias. In Darwin, Australia, Defense Minister John Moore said Indonesia had yet to give diplomatic clearance for the aid and that international peacekeepers would first need to be on the ground. The delay posed an immediate threat to at least 200,000 East Timorese, who the United Nations says there are at risk of starvation in the hills and forests of their ravaged homeland. The airdrops were scheduled to begin today, but are unlikely to be carried out before Sunday or Monday when the first multinational peacekeepers arrive. Indonesia's military chief, meanwhile, promised to pull out troops who've been accused of helping the militia violence. In Jakarta, General Wiranto said he would abide by an agreement on the peacekeeping operation between President B.J. Habibie and UN officials. This according to the official Antara news agency of Indonesia. Indonesia said today it's breaking off a four-year-old security treaty with Australia, which has harshly criticized Jakarta for its handling of the East Timor crisis. It was seen as a largely symbolic move because the treaty, concluded in 1995, is a broadly worded agreement recognizing only mutual interests in the region and pledging operation cooperation between the two nations. In Canberra, Australian Prime Minister John Howard warned today there could be casualties among 4,500 Australian troops being sent to East Timor. The expected total of peacekeepers is 7,000. There won't be any food drops in East Timor today. A soldier opened fire on staff officers at an infantry base in South Africa, killing six people before he was fatally shot. A seventh later died in a hospital. At least four people were wounded in the shootout at the base. The violence began this morning when the soldier began firing with a semi-automatic rifle at Tempe Military Base. The victims were unarmed, but other personnel returned fire. Russian investigators visiting the United States and Britain say those countries have not produced any evidence of an alleged Russian money laundering scheme at a U.S. bank. President Boris Yeltsin's government has been on the defensive following media reports that Russians were allegedly involved in laundering up to $10 billion through the Bank of New York. The reports have also said the Russian government may have mishandled money loaned by the International Monetary Fund. The reports have described it as potentially one of the biggest money laundering cases ever uncovered in the United States. The Roman Catholic Church will not apologize to Quebec orphans who say they were beaten and sexually abused in church-run psychiatric institutions decades ago. But Monsignor Pierre Marisset, who heads the Assembly of Quebec Bishops that issued the decision yesterday, said the bishops support the government's offer of $3 million to orphans who claim they were abused. The $3 million offer by Premier Lucien Bouchard's government has been rejected as inadequate. The church itself plans no compensation for the orphans. As children, most of them poor and born to single mothers, they were placed in church-run orphanages and psychiatric institutions during the period when Maurice Duplessis was premier of Quebec. Many of the 3,000 survivors claim they were beaten, molested, or raped at the institutions. Some allege they were given electroshocks and confined to straitjackets, even though there was nothing wrong with them. The latest apartment building explosion in Russia is now blamed for 17 deaths and some 115 injuries. Authorities suspect a truck bomb ripped through the nine-story building. Today's explosion is the fourth major blast involving a large apartment building in Russia during the past 2 weeks. Authorities are blaming Islamic militants for the previous bombings. The U.S. is preparing for this first significant easing of sanctions against North Korea since the end of the Korean War 46 years ago. Former Defense Secretary William Perry has recommended that President Clinton take the action now that North Korea has signaled it will halt testing of long-range missiles that could reach Alaska or Hawaii. The easing of sanctions would be the most significant gesture toward North Korea since 1953, including a modest trade opening that took effect in January 1995. And authorities have removed the victims of last night's church shooting in Fort Worth, Texas. A total of 8 people were killed, including the gunman who turned the gun on himself after opening fire in the church. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As I said in the news headlines today, there won't be any food drops over East Timor today. Officials in Australia have decided to hold off because Indonesia hasn't yet given diplomatic clearance for the aid. Australia had hoped to start the drops today. Officials also want to see peacekeepers on the ground before the drops begin, and the first troops aren't expected to arrive until Sunday or Monday. Meanwhile, it could take months to restore order to East Timor. That's the prediction of the Australian commander of the UN peacekeeping force heading to East Timor. But Major General Peter Cosgrove says he's up to the task. Cosgrove also has a warning for the Indonesian-backed militias who might target Australian troops. He said, lay down your weapons and surrender. Indonesian government officials are warning that militias may have it in for Australians because of their strong push for a UN force to put down the violence. Cosgrove also says he's not sure when troops will enter the region. Earlier, officials said the first troops could arrive this weekend. Well, daily we've been trying to bring you, as regularly as possible, reports from East Timor about what's happening on the ground. The latest reports we have that more than 100,000 refugees have been forcibly deported to West Timor. There, they're put into Indonesian refugee camps that are run by the Indonesian military and rampaged through by the Indonesian-backed militias. I just spoke to a Timorese friend who said that her brother got a call out from one of the West Timor refugee camps, and he said, "We are afraid. This is a terrifying place." Meanwhile, in East Timor, it's estimated that 200,000 to 300,000 people are in the mountains, have taken to the hills because of the terror, the reign of carnage that has been going on over the last few weeks in East Timor. It's also thought that thousands of people are dead. We're joined on the telephone right now by Alan Nairn. We've been following his saga, first his reports daily in East Timor, but then about 2 days ago, he was taken by the Indonesian military from a checkpoint on the road in East Timor. There he was brought to Kodam, which is the main army command of East Timor, under General Kiki, who is in charge of martial law in the country. He was then brought to Polda, which is the police station he'd been brought the week before, and watched intel, military soldiers, militia, police interrogating Timorese who were terrified and brought to the Polda station. Not clear where many of them are today. Well, Alan stayed in military detention in East Timor, and just in the last day was then flown on a plane to West Timor, where he's being held right now at the Immigration Center quarantine. Alan, welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes, hello.
Alan, we're going to play the statement that we recorded of yours earlier, but I was wondering before we do, so that you won't have to read it again and because there's so much dropout on the line, if you could give us the circumstances in which you gave this statement. What is happening to you now in West Timor, and exactly where are you?
Well, right now I'm in the quarantine building run by the Immigration Department, but it's guarded by a lot of military intel. The most significant thing, the plane that I was flown here on, the very charter plane that I was flown in on, I had two military police who were guarding me. But the other people who filled up the plane, several dozen men, they looked like militias. And I recognized some of them from the streets of Dili as among the more menacing Itaric militia people. Actually, it turns out these were all members of police intel, Indonesians, who were now being flown out of the same plane I was. Their assignment was completed and being flown back to Kupang here in West Timor, Indonesia. And they were getting on the plane with their militia outfits and their pistols and long rifles and knives and so on, and it was, you know, another example, illustration, face-to-face of how the militias are top-to-bottom military police operation.
What about everything else you saw on the way to the airport and what the Indonesian military was taking out?
Well, you know, as they were driving me to the airport, you could just see more of burnt-out Dili, the Coma Road, which goes to the airport. Every single one of the is gone. The only major structure still standing there is the former Australian consulate, where the skeleton of the UN now is. That place is built like a fort. But just about everything else is burnt out. Plane was taking off, and we were leaving Dili. I could see two major fires burning. One toward the south central part of town, and one a bit toward the east. The one in the south central part of town, huge. I don't know what it was, but it must have been a very large building.
And in terms of loot that the Indonesian military is taking out?
Well, I was actually supposed to be flown out on a U.S. C-130, they call Hercules, a big transport plane. But the military escort, they weren't me on that plane because it was full. It was just stuffed with, I couldn't for where these things came from, but it had a lot of them had looted goods. There are things like gasoline engines and electric generators that had been ripped from where they were. There were boxes and boxes of miscellaneous computer equipment and televisions. There was one entire truck, which a whole group of soldiers pushed into the cargo bay of the plane. So they were carrying a lot out of Timor. It was either looted stuff, or it was in with the plan laid out in a memo from the Office of Politics, the Ministry of Politics and Security, confidential memo that leaked about a month ago. And in that, they talked about how they would strip Timor of everything and destroy key facilities on the way out. And they certainly seem to be, to say the least. Here in Kupang, the person who's been a chief interrogator here, Mr. Soraya, said that there were 1,000 Timorese who were now East Timorese who were held in Kupang.
How many thousand?
Various.
How many thousand?
He said 40,000, 40. And in fact, one of them, and he pointed this out as we drove, I was being transported from the place I was being questioned to this quarantine center here, past his house, and he pointed to a whole bunch of East Timorese, being held right next to his house. And he's a top official, so he estimated 40,000. And I asked him, well, are these pro-integration or pro-independence people? And he laughed and said, well, they're all independents. And I asked him whether the Itarak, the base of Maraputi, and so on, were active in Kupang, because earlier in the, when I saw some of the, when I was standing out in front of the immigration office, I saw some of the some people who were dressed up like Itarik passing by on the motorcycle, and in fact, some of them were screaming at me. So I asked him, is Itarik and basically active in Kupang? And he said, yes, but they go after the East Timorese, and they only go after the pro-independence East Timorese.
Have you heard about the militias that are rampaging through the camps, Alan, near where you are, though you're not able to get out to see them?
Well, I haven't heard anything today because, as you said, I'm not free move. I'm a prisoner, basically, and I go where they bring me. But yesterday, about a day and a half ago, still in East Timor, I got a call on the hand phone from someone in West Timor who, in those camps, and they did describe a situation like that.
Alan, when we come back from the break, we're going to play the statement that you read, but before we go into the break, can you tell us the circumstances that you wrote the statement in the last hours?
Right now?
Yes. If you can just tell us the circumstances, we're going to play the statement so that it won't be breaking up as much as you are now.
Today, the interrogation today was very long. It was about, 4 hours, 5 hours, something like that. And the way they do it is they make up a written form, a written statement summarizing the questions and my answers. And when we got to item 18 in the Mr. Soraya said should give my own response to the charges against me, my own views. He said that there are two potential charges against me, both having to do with being here illegally in the eyes of the Army, in violence. The van and engaging in unauthorized activities. And he said that there's currently a debate among the ministers of the Carter government as to what to do with me. He said that some say face the jail term, which is based on showing me the regulations, 10 years maximum. And a $5 rupee fine, or another in Jakarta, he said, we're saying it should just be tossed out of the country, which to me seems politically much more likely as to what they're actually going to do. And I know that in their discussion in the office, they're all saying that General Wiranto, the Army commander would make the final decision, and that kind of on a hourly basis, the matter is being handled by Army in Jakarta. This was the, what you have the tape of is point 18, a statement of the interrogation report, my chance to make my own statement. I started, as with every, you know, he asked me that question, and I started to give my response, and he started to write. But after I had said the first sentence, and he'd written down the sentence, he got very uneasy, and he said, well, why don't you just write down the rest? He didn't want to put it down in his own handwriting.
Alan, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll hear the statement that you wrote down for the Indonesian military regime. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're speaking with detained journalist Alan Nairn. He has been banned from Indonesia for surviving the 1991 Santa Cruz massacre, in which more than 250 Timorese were killed, got into East Timor in 1990. Four after being arrested, and then re-entered in 1997 in spite of the ban, and again just in the last months has been in Indonesia and East Timor. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to journalist Alan Nairn's statement to the immigration authorities in Kupang, West Timor, where he is being interrogated throughout the day and then brought back to the detention facility where he's being held, the Immigration Center of Quarantine. This is what Alan Nairn wrote for the Indonesian military authorities just a few hours ago.
This is point 18 of the interrogation report on me. This is the part where I get to respond to the charges. I'll just read it quickly. I know that the Army has put me on the blacklist. They did this because I watched their soldiers murder more than 271 people at the Santa Cruz Cemetery. This crime was the responsibility of the Indonesian Army Commander, General Tri Sutrisno, and the Minister of Defense, General Benny Mardani. The murders were committed with American M16 rifles. The American government also bears some of the responsibility because they have armed, trained, and given money to the TNI Aubrey, even though they knew that TNI Aubrey is led by murderers and is responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Timorese, Achenese, West Papuan, and Indonesian civilians. Because I survived the massacre and denounced the crime to the outside world, the TNI Aubrey and the Suharto government banned me as a, quote, threat to national security, unquote. That ban has been reaffirmed by each subsequent TNI Aubrey commander, including General Faisal Tanjung and General Wiranto. I do not think that I am a threat to the Indonesian or Timorese people, but I hope that I am a threat to General Wiranto, General Tanjung, and the other present and former leaders of the TNI Aubrey. I believe that they feel threatened by anyone who would expose their crimes. General Wiranto and Generals Bambang, Zaki, Shafri, Kiki, and many others, for example, are responsible for the current militia terror in occupied East Timor and for the increase in repression against the people of Aceh. This is no secret to the people of Timor or the people of Indonesia or Aceh. They have suffered for decades under the repression and corruption of TNI Aubrey. Many brave Indonesians, Timorese, Achenese, and West Papuans have been killed, arrested, tortured, or raped because they dared to criticize the army and demand their right to freedom. As a foreigner and a journalist,
particularly an American journalist, I know that I enjoy a certain de facto political leeway that enables me to say things that local people would be killed for saying. I have tried to use that privilege to tell the truth about TNI Aubrey. If because of this the Army feels they must arrest or jail me, then I know that there is nothing I can do to stop them. But they know that they cannot arrest or kill all the people of Indonesia. That is why they are now so fearful. And that is why, I believe, they will lose their desperate struggle to retain their hold on power and their state. During my most recent detention, I have been interrogated by officials from Army Intel, Police Intel, Copassus Group 5, and many other units. They have asked me many questions about my political motives and opinions. I would summarize my opinions this way. I am pro-human rights, pro-democracy, and anti-TNI Aubrey. I am a supporter of the people of East Timor, Aceh, West Papua, and Indonesia, and an opponent of the officials who have repressed and exploited them. As an American citizen who is visiting Indonesia and occupied East Timor, I also want to be clear that I believe in even-handedness. The same political, moral, and legal standards that are applied to TNI Aubrey officers should also be applied to the officers and political leaders of the United States. So while I support the UN Secretary General's call for war crimes, crimes against humanity prosecutions on East Timor, I think that the prosecution should not be limited to Indonesian officials. Foreign officials who have been accomplices to atrocities in East Timor by providing murder weapons and the logistics of repression should also be investigated, charged, prosecuted, and, if convicted, jailed. Pragmatically, it is hard to imagine General Wiranto sitting in jail. It is even harder to imagine President Clinton sitting as his cellmate. But justice should be impartial. It is time for amnesty to end. Untold thousands of Timorese lie slaughtered. Their families are bereft. The victims of Santa Cruz, Ikisa, and Swai can no longer speak. Those of us should insist that the killing stop right now. And we should insist that the killers face justice, regardless of who they are. These same principles apply, of course, to atrocities everywhere. That this is a simple idea, and that most people would agree. If General Wiranto or any other officials had further questions about my views, I would be glad to answer personally at a time and place of their choosing. I would also be glad to give details on the crimes referred to above and on complicity in them of General Wiranto and other officials.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
And that was journalist Alan Nairn reading his statement that he has now given to the Indonesian military authorities. Alan, who has been reporting from the ground in East Timor through the last weeks, the Nation magazine published his report, U.S. Complicity in Timor, last week. And in the introduction from the editors to that report, they said, while the Indonesian military's thugs continue their rampage in East Timor, most foreign reporters fled the country. As of September 7th, frequent Nation contributor and award-winning journalist Alan Nairn was one of the only U.S. reporters still there. Nairn left the besieged U.N. compound and walked the streets of Dili, where he hid in abandoned houses as he observed troops and militia burning and looting. He's been writing about the troubles there for years. In 1991, after being badly beaten by Indonesian troops while witnessing the massacre of several hundred Timorese, he was declared a threat to national security and banned from the country. He's entered several times illegally since then. In his nation dispatch from East Timor on March 30, 1998, Allen disclosed the continuing U.S. military training of Indonesian troops implicated in the torture and killing of civilians. This last report, U.S. complicity in Timor, filed last week, was reported by satellite phone to the nation through Democracy Now, as we were afraid that there was no other way to get the report out. Allen, we hope you're still on the line from us. It is a strange situation being able to talk to you as you are in detention. Allen picked up 2 days ago in Dili, East Timor, by the Indonesian military, brought to the Central Army Command, then flown to East Timor, where he remains in detention. Allen, we just have a minute, and I know that at any point we could lose you on the phone. Can you tell us again what they say you face and what is your circumstance? I mean, it is critical to get these on-the-ground reports, and I believe that's why they picked you up, for the same reason that they were able to kill a third of the population since 1975. They want the country closed to the outside world, and you were the eyes and ears that kept it open just a bit for us to peek in. What's happening now in terms of your case?
I think it's probably true. At first they were... You know, they just picked me up seeing a foreigner on the streets, and that moment I was probably the only foreigner left on the streets of Dili. Then, in the course of the day, as they found out who I was, you know, it got higher level attention, and General Key became personally involved, and now they say General Wiranto is involved, but you know, they're based in Dili. Part of one facet of their plan has been to drive the foreigners out as they burn down the town, clear out much of the population, and probably do even worse in the countryside. They already succeeded in clearing out most of the foreigners from the countryside several weeks.
But right now, Allen, what is the sentence you face, and what can people do?
Well, they said today they said, you know, possibly 10 years in prison. Very unlikely. I don't think that'll happen. I don't think I'll do any prison time. I think I'll probably be tossed out of there sometime in the next, tossed out of Indonesia sometime in the next few days. But it's now a matter of... you know, Wiranto and the other ministers are batting around and deciding what to do.
Do you have any concerns about the military hearing this?
About what?
About the military hearing this. Also, if you could tell us about the news conference that they had you hold while you were still in Dili.
Well, I don't have any concerns with hearing this. I mean, they know where I stand, and, you know, I wrote that statement for them. I mean, at their request, that was a written statement that I submitted as part of my interrogation report. When I was in being held at Korem military headquarters in, I guess it was a bit more than a day ago now, maybe it was a day and a half ago. At one point, all these Indonesian reporters came into the room I was being held in, of them with TV cameras, others with radio microphones. They had been staying at, I think they had just been brought into Timor, and they had been staying at the Korem complex, and they said they had just spoken to General Kiki, and he had told them about my case, and he told them to come in and ask me some questions. And so it became an impromptu or an unexpected, on my part, press conference. There were about 7 or 8 reporters. I don't know if any of what I said was actually reported in the Indonesian press, but that's how it started.
Alan?
Hello?
Well, hello? Yes. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Yeah. You've been calling for an arms embargo against Indonesia for what it's done in East Timor. President Clinton, while he said he was cutting off military weapon sales and military relations, has already hinted that he will restore the relationship of the United States to the Indonesian military as soon as peacekeepers go in. What do you think of that?
I think the U.S. cutoff of support for CNI should be total and final. This is not only the army that has killed a third of the population in Timor and occupied it illegally. It's the same army that is now doing horrible slaughter in Aceh and is repressing and denying democracy throughout Indonesia. You know, Indonesia just went through a long, and it's still in the middle of, actually, this long electoral process, which is supposed to be a herald of the beginning of representative democratic government in Indonesia. And here is General Wiranto and the army making a joke of the whole thing by just spitting in the face of the incumbent president, President Habibie. Habibie, even though he himself is an old Suharto protege, and even though himself for many years he was kind of the Albert Speer of the Indonesian military, he was the man who ran the arms building industries, as president he did do at least one commendable thing. Well, he did several. I mean, he released some political prisoners. He opened up the press a bit. But he also announced that he would accept a UN-sponsored vote, referendum in Timor, and then abide by the results. And it's very clear that Habibie does not support this insane militia terror that the army is using to burn down East Timor at the moment, but he is completely helpless to stop it, even though he's the president of the country. So this army is a menace not just to the Timorese, but to the Indonesians and to the idea of democracy in Indonesia. So the U.S. should stop supporting this regime completely, not just on the military side, but also with World Bank and IMF funds. And the same goes for Britain and Australia and Belgium and many of the other Western powers that help to prop this army up. And I think that would hasten the army's downfall. I don't think this army is going to last and win politically. I think they will lose. I think over time they'll be defeated by the pro-democracy forces. But if the U.S. were to pull the plug on them, that would really quicken their exit, make it much less bloody, mean that far fewer Indonesians will die in the process, and open the door for some kind of democratic change in Indonesia.
Alan, as we wrap up with you, and I always hate to get off because it is, just concern about your safety and also ability to get back in touch with you. And it's been extremely difficult to reach you, though listeners might be wondering, as we said before in the last few days, how it is with the brutality of the Indonesian regime. You can actually speak on a cell phone. It sort of redefines the term cell phone. But why is it, again, that they let you use this?
Well, it's all pretty peculiar. I mean, the short answer is I'm an American, I'm a journalist, and I'm a high-profile political case. So they treat me with kid gloves. If I was an Indonesian or a Timorese in this same situation, I'd be in very big trouble. They've tortured and killed people for far less. At the same time, one of the peculiarities of the style of the Indonesian prison system is that this sounds very strange, but I hope the listeners will bear with me. If you're not being tortured, and if you happen to be a high-profile or relatively high-profile case in the Indonesian political case in the Indonesian prison system, you often end up with a lot more leeway than you would, say, in an American prison. It's inconceivable that if I were being detained in any way by the American penal authorities, even the Immigration Department, there's no way that I would be on a cell phone doing an interview, regardless of who I was, regardless of the politics surrounding it. But it's one of the oddities of the Indonesian system. Shinana found that out. Shinana, the Timorese resistance leader who was in prison until just a few days ago, after he was captured in 92, he was able to get away with an awful lot in prison in terms of maintaining contact with the outside world. So were many of the higher-profile Indonesian political dissidents. If they had been in jail in the U.S., or and not even for political matters, but to the people in the U.S. who were now imprisoned, for example, let's say for the School of the Americas protests, or the various protests, you know, people who've gone onto military bases and done symbolic desecrations of the airplanes. They're often under very tight lockdown conditions, which are actually much worse in some respects than those faced by political detainees in Indonesia. So there's that peculiarity in the Indonesian system, and that plus the fact that I'm an American, so I'm able to get away with something like this, talking on the cell phone, although quietly, even though I'm not free to go and even though I'm constantly interrogated.
What would be the most helpful way to get you out of that detention cell? Because by you being there, we, aside from being deeply concerned about your safety, we can't get reports directly from East Timor and West Timor from the Indonesian archipelago precisely what the regime wants.
Well, I mean, the first priority is to get the Indonesian army out of Timor, and that could happen within days or weeks. People just have to keep the pressure up on that to see to it that the U.S. Cuts them clean, and there's just nothing left of U.S. support, and that will very quickly cause, we're on to pull the plug on the terror and the occupation in Timor. I mean, my case is very minor in the whole scheme of things.
Well, we thank you for doing what you're doing, Alan Nairn, in detention in Kupang, West Timor, and now being threatened with either expulsion or up to 10 years in prison. And ultimately, as Alan said, it is up to the general of the armed forces to decide, Wiranto, that according to the head of immigration that is questioning Alan in the Kupang Immigration Center. Perhaps at the end of the show we will give out some numbers, but since you won't say it, I would say I think the most effective way to get Alan out so that we can continue this kind of reporting and also protect a journalist who is extremely brave is to call your senator and congress member and tell them to call, demand of the State Department and demand of the Indonesian regime that they let him go. If you want to add arms embargo and halt a U.S. Support of IMF and World Bank loans, it seems to be all part of the same picture. Again, the Indonesian regime responsible for more than 200,000 Timorese deaths, and in the last weeks, the massive displacement of three-quarters of the Timorese population, an untold number of people dead. And there, Alan sits in detention, and General Wiranto and Foreign Minister Ali Alatas and President B.J. Habibie walk around freely. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'll also add that as Alan spoke in detention to the Lehrer NewsHour, he was confined, but the person who had to respond to his charges was Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Secretary of State. She was free to leave after the interview. Stay with us.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with our international coverage today and the War and Peace Report that we've been bringing you on and off over the last weeks and months with Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now!'s correspondent in Yugoslavia. In Belgrade this week, Serbian Premier Mirko Marjanovic denied that Yugoslavia was on the brink of a severe economic crisis and fended off accusations that the government will soon be forced to devalue the country's currency. Marjanovic also accused the United States of working with opposition groups in the country to sell out Yugoslavia's sovereignty for international loans and private investment. His statements come as state television in Yugoslavia has launched a massive propaganda campaign to convince people that the country's recovering rapidly from NATO's bombardment. But as Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill reports from Belgrade, people on the streets aren't buying it.
This commercial airs constantly on Radio Television Serbia. It shows construction workers rebuilding homes, schools, and factories across the country and states that Yugoslavia is showing the world that it is rebuilding. It's just one commercial of many aimed at convincing people they have nothing to worry about. But in the last 2 weeks, people on the streets, in the markets, just about everywhere, have seen many indications that that's simply not true. 51-year-old Vesna Nikitovic works at a large post office and bank in Belgrade.
I every week see that the prices are going up, and I'm astonished, really. It's amazing how they can hide that everything is under control and everything is okay. It's not. It really isn't. We know that these are hard times for all of us, but, you know, some people can do everything, and some thinkable people can't do almost nothing. And it hurts when you see that you are unable to do anything, but you can see clearly what's going on.
Nikitovic is a single mother with two daughters. She has worked at the post office for 24 years. Before NATO's bombing, her salary was roughly $170 a month, well above the country's average salary. When the war began, her wages were reduced by a third. 2 weeks ago, she was told she was being placed on forced leave. Now Vesna Nikitovic doesn't go to work, and she receives 70% of her already reduced wages. In real terms, that's just a little more than $50 a month.
I tried to save my girls from problem. I don't speak loudly of that. I try to earn everything I can so that they don't see, but they are grown up and they see that I can't, if we eat meat today, we can't eat it every day. Or if I buy some supplies 1 month, another, I can buy only the other one. I can't buy everything for a month in 1 month.
And what Vesna Nikitovic can buy with her salary is getting less and less every week. The independent economist group G17 estimates that last week alone, the government put 400 million new dinars into circulation, causing the exchange rates on the black market to rise immediately and consistently. This, in turn, caused an almost overnight inflation in supermarkets and retail stores and nearly doubled the black market price of gasoline. In Yugoslavia, workers' salaries are calculated in dinars and not the Deutschmark or dollar. In plain English, that means people's salaries hold less and less value as prices rise daily. Srba Antic is an economist with G17.
You know, due to bombing, wages are going down for 40% because at the same amount, our GDP in real terms is going down, so it's clear that we cannot have the same wages as before. So we have a very severe fall of real wages, and with this inflation, wages are even lower in real terms, of course.
The government denies it is printing new money, but the merchants on Knez Mihailova Street in downtown Belgrade know that's not true.
Yeah, yes, I'm standing on the street. I work with new dinners every day. They look like they smell from printed. How do you call that? They're fresh. They're new. I mean, because on black market, Deutschmark is now getting dinner is falling down. Deutschmark is getting up. So that's all because of new dinners. I mean, government is printing new dinners to give the retirees, let's call it pensions to give. I mean, to give salaries to teachers, to university professors. I don't know what other things they need. They don't have money. They don't. Taxes are not enough, to give them money. So they are printing new money. That's wrong, of course.
Do you think they're doing that because the elections are coming up?
Yes, one of the reasons is that because of elections. That's the main reason. I mean, they have to, buy electors from themselves. Only way is to print new money, give them some money to make them feel, okay.
Yugoslavia is no stranger to economic crisis. In July of 1993, corruption, financial mismanagement, and economic sanctions drove the country into one of the worst economic catastrophes of modern history. Inflation skyrocketed, and the streets were flooded with new banknotes, with number values too high to count. People walked the streets with 500 trillion dinar bills that could barely buy a newspaper. Supermarkets were virtually empty, and many retired people were reduced to scavenging in garbage cans to find food. And with the government here struggling to maintain control of the country, some economists fear that Yugoslavia may be on the verge of a return to 1993.
It's something you don't have in economic textbooks, not even in footnotes.
Dr. Goran Milicevic is professor of economics at the University of Belgrade.
Since you don't have economic reason behind all this, you have a political reason of staying in power of this present regime. And it's kind of a peculiar manner that they are defending their interests. They are taking care about economy only just enough to keep them in power. Otherwise, they're not interested at all in the economy and in survival of the whole economy.
One of the most severe developments to surface as a result of NATO's 78 days of bombing is that domestic production of gasoline is now almost non-existent. NATO repeatedly attacked refineries, storage facilities, even gas stations. 2 weeks ago, lines of cars stretched for miles in front of Yugopetrol stations, guzzling up the last of the country's fuel. Now there are no lines because there's no gas. Only the black market offers fuel illegally imported from neighboring Romania, and that is sold at prices comparable to those in the United States. Economist Serba Antic from the independent economist group G17 says this fuel shortage will have devastating effects on the availability of food in large cities across the country.
And the problem of gasoline is also, it's not easy to tackle with that because we have to import a lot of gasoline. Our refineries are destroyed and people cannot move the goods from the agricultural region to Belgrade. So that's also why these prices are going up. We will have a very, very severe winter and very big problems in supplying all the inhabitants of the bigger towns.
The coming winter worries nearly everyone here. The government-run electric power industry of Serbia estimates that Yugoslavia lost one-third of its electric capacity due to NATO's bombing. NATO's new graphite bombs, each containing 3 miles of string-like fiber, fell on electric transformers and power stations, covering the wires and coils. On contact, the fiber short-circuited power facilities, causing widespread damage to Serbia's electrical system. This happened on at least 4 occasions, and repairs are far behind. The estimate to fix the entire system is about $200 million, $50 million more than Serbia's estimated Federal Reserves. But even still, economist Serba Antic, who holds a Ph.D. in electric power systems, says it will be impossible to fix the system before winter, even if the country had the money to do it.
No, it is not possible because we have very serious damages of transformers on a transmission grid. You need at least 6 to 8 months to produce it because there is no spares, and you have to ask in advance for them to be built. So even in the best possible situation, we will have these transformers at the end of the winter. So we will have a lot of problems in the winter because mainly people use electricity for heating in Serbia.
Antic says NATO's bombs hit hard at the electrical control systems in Yugoslavia, making it virtually impossible to ensure that even so-called priority users, such as hospitals, schools, and nursing homes, will have heat or electricity for the winter. He is calling on the countries that bombed Yugoslavia to pay for special generators for these institutions.
We advocate that some kind of humanitarian aid for vulnerable groups have to be available for maybe kindergartens, schools, hospitals, and maybe this is the way how to provide this type of humanitarian aid.
But as desperate as times seem to be getting, the government that has ruled Yugoslavia for the past 10 years has shown an extraordinary ability to maintain its power. Again, economist Goran Milicevic.
It's a kind of perverse sophistication that approximately they're seeing what can pass since people are not fighting back. You know, there's not organized strikes. They were tried before. It's very hard to explain to you since we have to speak about what has happened during these 10 years or so. They were deliberately provoking strikes, huge strikes. For instance, all of the health workers strike in a period of several weeks just to show that it has to fail. That it cannot succeed. You had strikes almost on a daily basis, first in one region, then in another region, but only after first strike ends. So they had this kind of experience. It's hard to believe, but all the people in the syndicates and trade unions are telling us so. So there must be something of it. And so they approximately know what is the margin, how far they can go.
The Institute for Economic Sciences in Belgrade this week announced that the average salary in Serbia, measured at the black market exchange rate, is about $40 a month. That's down from $90 in 1998. A recently published UN study found that 2 million of Yugoslavia's 10 million citizens live below the poverty line. Times are undoubtedly getting worse here, but Professor Milicevic says don't look to organized labor as a force of resistance to the government.
Well, first you have to know that the working population is reduced to one-third, so there is not such a force. Who is going to strike? People who are out of work already, but they are working something else to survive. They are selling at those flea markets or whatever. They are selling this, smuggling oil, whatever, and there is no time for them. They are too busy to strike. To go on strike, you have to be first employed. And those who are employed, they are in fear that they are going to lose even that job they have, and they are reluctant to go on smuggling like others are. That's what's keeping them more or less, how should I say, quiet or not trying to shake things too much. And even when you have these trade unions negotiating with the government, it makes you cry when you learn what are their demands to receive second half of the wage from the February in this year, and some very small amount, all in all, less than, let's say, a couple of hundred Deutschmarks per capita. And this is what they would be satisfied with. So it's really awful.
The U.S.-led NATO attacks against Yugoslavia over the last 10 years, both militarily and economically, fit into a well-known model of U.S. foreign policy: punish the people while preserving the government. In Iraq, the U.S. has enforced a devastating and unprecedented regime of economic sanctions that have killed more than 1 million people. These sanctions are supplemented with regular bombings on the country. Yet Saddam Hussein remains in power. And today in Yugoslavia, several months after the bombs stopped falling, those who have been fighting against the government here are left wondering why NATO attacked them and thousands of other civilians. And that's the kind of question 50-year-old Vesna Nikitovic asks as she fears the rapidly approaching winter and shops in stores with less products and higher prices.
And NATO just did the thing worse.
And that report from Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230. Hope you can call your Congress member or senator today because of a massive storm in Washington. They may be in their home districts all over the country. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Donna Neiman and Maria Carrion. Bernard White is our engineer. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.